You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 1st, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
How y'all doing tonight?
Pretty good.
I had a moment in life happen this week. My son is going to be 4 in 2 days, and last week he opened up the whole let's talk about death topic.
Nice.
So, oh, wow. Okay, here we go.
Total coincidence, 2.5 weeks ago, Steve said, hey, have you talked to Dylan about death or anything yet? And I'm like, no, hell no, I'm not talking to him about that. You know, I was like, why would I do that to him? Like, you know, and Steve said, if he brings it up, you have to talk to him about it.
Now, Wait a minute. Hold on. Let's pause here. Uncle Steve.
Yeah.
Maybe... Did you have a conversation with Dylan that might have sparked his interest?
No, curiosity?
Oh, is this Steve's fault? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm just saying.
No. Actually, Jay, you told me that it had come up because your dogs had died, but you hadn't really had the talk with him.
Yeah.
And that's when I was saying, yes, if so, like what we did with our daughters is when it came up, because like when Julia was 2, our dog that we had at the time died, and people in our lives have been dying, you know, just every now and then. And we just told them just straight up, just, yep, you know, everything lives, everything dies, everything that's alive will die eventually. It's a part of the natural cycle of life. And, you know, just said it matter-of-factly, like, yep, this is just the way it is.
Did you say anything like, you don't have to worry about it because you're really young and healthy?
Well, we didn't really have to.
Okay.
Yeah, we didn't sugarcoat it, but we didn't attach any big significance to it. It was just like, yep, mm-hmm. This is the way it is. And they were young enough that didn't really have an emotional impact on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So they were able, I think, to sort of intellectually sort of grapple with this notion before they started to like understand the implications of this. Mm-hmm. But I think, Jay, you had a slightly different experience.
Yeah, well, my son did have an emotional experience. So you know, my dad is, he's 86 and he's unstable and he falls down every once in a while. And mm-hmm. recently, like, you know, a week or two ago, my dad had a pretty hard hit. He's fine, but, you know, he definitely bumped his head and everything. So Dylan asked my wife, he's like, so why is Poppy falling down all the time? And my wife's like, well, honey, you know, he's really old. And when you get old, your body doesn't work as well as it used to. And he, you know, sometimes he can't keep himself up. And he made a total connection between that and the dogs. And he said, is Poppy going to go away like our dogs did? So my wife had to say, yes, yeah, he will, honey. You know, and she started to explain it to him. And as soon as my wife said, I saw it come over his face, like he got it on some level. And, you know, when Dylan cries, there's a bunch of different cries. You know, keep in mind, he's 4 years old. There's the fake cry. There's the I want something cry. You know, there's the I'm hurt cry. And then there's like the actual physical pain. And then this was one we haven't really experienced before, like the deep emotional pain one. And he did it. It was really like, you know, he just kind of withdrew into himself and he was like, oh, you know, he was like showing this awful look on his face and he was, you know, really feeling it. And he said, I don't want Poppy to go away. You know, and he was saying things like that. And then he said, I am not going to die, Mommy. I'm young and I'm never going to die. So
that's
he immediately made the connection to himself.
Yep.
Yeah.
He did.
Right. And Courtney told him, you're so going to die.
Yeah, right.
No, we told him that he is a demigod and he's going to live forever.
Well, he is that.
But,
yeah.
You know, there was a few things about the whole thing that were awesome and really difficult. This is a hard thing. It's very hard. You know, death for me is in particular one of the hard things for me to deal with. You know, I don't want my kids to have to worry about it and really think about it. But I do agree with Steve. I feel like I don't want it to be waited till they're – I don't want to wait till they're much older. Like I'd rather have them kind of start chipping away at it now. I'm definitely not going to bring it up a lot or whatever. Like if he wants to talk about it, great. If something happens and we need to talk about it, fine. But I'm still going to back away from it.
But it's not like if you didn't talk about it, they would figure it out, right?
Yeah, like, but there. I think there's a difference.
It's hard to avoid the understanding of death.
But, you know, Kara, I got to tell you, it didn't hit me hard. It didn't really hit me until I was about 17.
Well, it doesn't really hit anybody at the level of true understanding, really, until they lose somebody.
Yeah.
It's like you can understand it conceptually, but then when you actually lose somebody, then you really understand what that loss feels like. That said, a four-year-old connecting it to himself and immediately saying, like, am I going to die? That's, like, very, I don't know, cognitively advanced. It's interesting that that was where he took it.
And yeah. Dylan's a smart kid. But then, Jay, what you said, you told me, or I think Courtney told me what he said next, or so, like, later on he tells, you know, his mother, Courtney, Jay's wife, he says, you know, Mommy, I'm going to tell Poppy that he can't die.
Yeah.
He's just he's not going to do it. I'm not going to let him do it.
Yeah.
Just not going to happen. Wow. Yeah. Like, as if, like, he has a choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Aww. Yeah. It was funny.
That's so sweet.
I'm really hoping that the zombies in my room didn't contribute to this anyway.
Yeah, but Dylan has a morbid fascination with Uncle Bob's room. It's cool.
So does Bob.
But
it's partly morbid. It's also, it's awesome Halloween. Place to visit. I've got robots over here. I've got zombies over here. I've got pirate treasure over there. My place is awesome.
Well,
so, especially to a four-year-old.
But Jay,
make a Disney World.
That means you're going to have to go. You're going to go through a whole other experience of that realization on his face when you make that connection for him. You know how we were talking about death and how dogs die and how Poppy's going to die? Those things in Bob's bedroom were dead.
Yeah, that's right.
Not going to be fun for him at all.
He's so cute because he's like Uncle Bob. I know they're just plastic. They're just a little scared. They're not real. They're made of plastic. But meanwhile, I know he could have horrible dreams about those as well, those plastic things.
Of course.
For sure.
Mind of a four-year-old? Definitely.
Bob, you're going to love this. So he's like telling me about your treasure.
Yeah, treasure.
I'm like, Dylan, it's not treasure. What's treasure? I'm like, it's treasure. So he tried to say it in a deep voice. It was the weirdest thing that ever came out of his mouth because he can't do a deep voice. He physically cannot make himself do a deep voice. So it came out like a squeak because he was just trying to do something. It was like, it sounded like, it was like, treasure. Like, that was like, it was awesome.
Oh my God.
Classic.
That's awesome.
Aww.
Yeah. That's my boy.
Okay. Bob.
Yeah.
Get us started with Forgotten Superheroes of Science.
So for this week's Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm going to talk about Rudolf Diesel, 1858 to 1913. He's a German inventor and mechanical engineer and famous for the invention of the diesel engine. Now, this is an interesting story. I walked into a cafe last week in Boston, and on the wall, they had an entire wall dominated by a huge display of what appeared to be like a chalkboard drawing, very accurate, of a big diesel engine, a primitive diesel engine. And then to the right of it, they had this big, long paragraph talking about this guy, Rudolf Diesel, and what he accomplished. And I was just fascinated by this description of him and what he accomplished. And, you know, when I think of diesel, I mean, I think diesel fuel, diesel engine. I never really tied the word diesel to a person. I'm sure I've heard of him, but just somebody that just really isn't really talked about. And I'm sure, you know, the guy, lots of people know about him and his contribution, but I think he's still a little bit of an unsung hero, especially with the gasoline engine taking up all the press. You know, the diesel engine is like, a little redheaded stepson type of scenario. So I wanted to just throw out some stuff that I found out about Rudolf Diesel.
Yeah, but Bob, I have to say, though, you know, he's only a pseudo-forgotten superhero. Because
if
you have something named after yourself, you got the credit for it. You're not forgotten.
That's true.
And I sometimes will definitely talk about semi-forgotten. But like I said, I mean, when you think Diesel, I mean, I rarely think of that name attached to a real person. You know, I just don't – I never think of this guy and what he did. And so that's why. And sometimes it's just my ignorance. And it's like most people, like, Bob, come on. Diesel, of
Bob's
course.
Forgotten.
But it's not, guys, yeah, it's Bob's, not uncommon.
Okay. So for this week's Bob semi-forgotten superhero of science, I'm going to talk about Rudolf Diesel. So Diesel's parents, when he was young, Diesel's parents had a very different idea of what they wanted their 14-year-old to do. But he told them that he wanted to be an engineer. In 1880, he graduated with the highest honors from the Royal Bavarian Polytechnic of Munich. Did very, very well in class. Very bright guy. So he was fascinated by thermodynamics and fuel efficiency and tried to make steam engines more efficient, which are notoriously inefficient. I think it's something on the order of 10%. I mean, at least especially back then. Not necessarily the turbines of today, but back then they were pretty bad. So he tried to create one that was more efficient using ammonia vapor. But it exploded and sent him to the hospital for months. And then he decided to build an engine based on the Carnot cycle. The Carnot cycle basically describes, it's not a bicycle that you can ride or anything like that. It describes the thermodynamic limits of an engine, of what an engine can achieve when it's converting heat into work. So it's basically this template you can compare it to. It's an idealized kind of scenario. So like I said, he's way into thermodynamics. So he then wrote a paper called The Theory and Construction of a Rational Heat Engine to Replace the Steam Engine and Combustion Engines Known Today. So this treatise or paper that he wrote was ultimately his template for his invention of the diesel engine, which he then created soon after Benz got his patent for his internal combustion engine, which not just his engine, but actually the first real practical car using an internal combustion engine. So what amazes me about diesel is that imagine you're inventing a mechanical device in the 1870s or 80s, and it's still being widely used 130 years later. Now, sure, it's not the gas engine, which kind of just permeated, you know, motor vehicles all over the place, but the diesel engine did become a very, very important replacement for the steam engine in many various uses, even back in the day, soon after he invented it, and for, you know, decades leading up to today. The diesel engine generally is quite robust and heavy. So, and therefore, that's why it really wasn't used much in cars and airplanes. But if you had an application that required high torque and low RPMs, diesels were perfect. So that's why it's in trucks everywhere to this day. It's also in agricultural engines, stationary engines. Those niches are it dominates. And also they have created relatively recently, they've created kind of lightweight diesel engines that can be used in airplanes, things where, you know, where weight is an absolute premium. So remember Rudolf Diesel. Mention him to your friends, perhaps when discussing isothermal heat rejection or reversible adiabatic processes.
Or the next time you get stuck behind a tractor trailer.
Yes. Yes. Bob. Yo, Jay.
You know, I was going to say, it's not uncommon for the people that invent a product when they use their name, for people to not know it, like the guy that invented the Bic pen.
That was a guy?
Yeah, well, his name was B-I-C-H, and he changed it to B-I-C, but nobody knows that that's the name of the original person. I think that's really interesting. There's a lot of products out there where you don't know it's derivative of or the name of the person that invented it. It's just the thing, you know?
Yeah, like Thomas Crapper.
Isn't that a myth?
What a myth.
What was the other one? John Titzlinger?
Invented the bra?
No way, Evan. Come on.
You haven't heard
that? No, it was a German guy, Bustenhalter.
No, the guy's last name was Stoppen Sie von Flappen.
Oh, my God.
Oh, gosh.
All right. Kara, tell us about human pig chimeras.
Human pig chimeras. Ooh, finally. You guys have seen this all over the news, haven't you?
And from Seinfeld.
You need to add a bear. Man, bear, pig.
Yes.
Man,
bear, pig. Pigman from Seinfeld is kind of the obvious one, I think.
It's funny, too, because not many people have made that connection in science news. But you've seen this trending all over social media. You've seen articles where basically every science outlet has written about this. Probably the biggest thing that they've gotten wrong is the connections that they're making between this very interesting, in and of itself, basic research and a discussion of it being kind of a bigger part of applied research, which not only is it nowhere near ready to become part of that applied research, it may never become part of that applied research. So let's talk about what that means. Pretty much every headline on this human pig chimera or human pig hybrid story is that scientists are one step closer to growing human organs inside of an animal. And once those organs have been grown, we can take them out, graft them into the human, and then we'll have basically these wonderful organ farms, and we'll never have to wait on an organ transplant list ever again.
Only 100 steps to go.
Exactly.
And we're practically there.
There's actually a really good article that I found in National Geographic, which does a great job, I think, in the second half of explaining the science of
the parts that nobody reads.
Exactly, of doing their due diligence and writing exactly what was happening in the lab to get to this point. The problem is, not only is the lead about the idea of these organ transplant lists, basically the whole first half of a not too short article is all about the background of organ transplant, why it would be necessary for us to be able to do this for organ transplant. And it's a bummer because this in no way helps us with organ transplant, at least not anytime soon. So here's the narrative that we're reading in a lot of different articles, and you've probably come across this too. The narrative is, okay, I've got somebody who needs a new liver or somebody who needs new lungs or a new heart. They can either wait for a new liver, lung, or heart to come up from a beating heart cadaver, and we can transplant that in, or we can try to produce one for them. What are the different ways that we can produce an organ for a person? Well, we could house the organ in a different person, but that doesn't really seem ethical. We could try and grow it outside of an organism, right? Like in a lab in a petri dish, which we've seen plenty of articles and actually really good work being made towards that. It requires a lot of scaffolding. It's very complicated. It's not unlike growing in vitro meat, right? Which we know is the $30,000 hamburger. I think it's a little cheaper now. And then the last thing you might think of is, oh, we'll just try and grow like an ear on the back of a pig, like, or an ear on the back of a mouse. We've seen all of these like stock photos of this. The problem is that's way harder than it sounds. There has been some really cool research done in this area prior to this new study, which they piggybacked off of. I didn't even do that on purpose. And that in and of itself, yeah, that in and of itself is interesting. But the point of this is actually so much more fundamental. The real question is, how do we grow tissue from one species in a different species in order to do all sorts of things, but to really just better understand how those species develop at the embryonic level? So prior to this pig human, quote, chimera or hybrid that you've been reading about, some really fascinating research was done with mice and rats. You take a rat, you take these pluripotent stem cells out of the rat. Now, pluripotent stem cells are stem cells from a very specific developmental period. It's not the very first developmental period, but it's just soon after that. So these cells can't necessarily become anything, but they can become basically anything. They're not as developed as, what are they called, the later stages, multipotent stem cells.
Yeah.
But they're also not totipotent, which are the earliest stages. You have to grab them just at the right time, which is not very easy. So they find these pluripotent stem cells just at the right time in a rat while the rat's developing. They pull them out and then they inject them just at the right time into a mouse embryo. And what they found was that the mouse actually developed or incorporated these rat stem cells. Now, the way that they did that, which was ingenious because it was rejecting and rejecting and they couldn't figure out how to kind of overcome that barrier, the way they did that is they did genetic engineering using CRISPR to tell the cells within the mouse not to grow a particular organ. I think in this case, it was a pancreas. So they were like, developing mouse embryo, you don't have the blueprint or you don't have the cells necessary to put together a pancreas. We're going to then force these rat cells, which could become pancreas, into your embryo. And when your organism as a whole realizes that it can't make pancreas and pancreas is required for life, it will just incorporate the rat pluripotent cells into a pancreas. And they did that and they were successful. They produced what we call a chimera, which is an organism that has cells, DNA from two completely different species inside of it.
So it developed a pancreas because of the necessity of
Needing a pancreas.
Needing a pancreas.
Exactly. And they were even able to then later take some of that pancreatic tissue, put it back in a rat that they had engineered to have diabetes, and they saw some improvement, which is freaking crazy. Beyond that, they said, well, we want to try and put this in a pig because pigs are more like people. And that'll be the next obvious step. So they took some rat cells, they did the same thing, and they tried to put them in pigs. And then no matter what they did, they wouldn't take. And they kind of they weren't really surprised because there are a lot of differences. Rats and pigs are very different. Rats and mice, kind of similar. Similar gestational periods, similar developmental phases. Rats and pigs, not so much. But pigs and people, as we've probably all heard, do have a lot of similarities in our embryonic development. So when they decided to try it with pigs and people, take human embryonic stem cells, these pluripotent stem cells, inject it into the pig blastocyst just at the right time. It was not easy. They failed many, many times. And out of the thousands and thousands, I actually have the exact number here, out of the 2,181 pig blastocysts that they injected with pluripotent cells and then cultured in vitro, so that, you know, obviously they were outside of the organism. They weren't like in the womb. They got 2,075 embryos out of that. So not too many of them died at the beginning, which is great. They then implanted them into host pigs. They put them back in the womb, about 40 to 50 embryos at a time. And they collected at the end 186 viable embryos, which is impressive. It's not that many. The yield is quite low, but it's still impressive. And then when they went through and they looked how many of these actually have incorporated human cells in them, they found that their yield was 0.001, which is quite low, but still very impressive.
Yeah, so one human cell for every 100,000 pig cells.
Pig cells, exactly. Yeah. So let's think about what that really means. That's not an organ, first of all, at all. One human cell for every, what did we say, 10,000?
100,000.
100,000 pig cells. That's definitely not an organ. It's also very difficult to know exactly where and which cells became that, right? Because it's one human cell then surrounded by all of these supportive pig cells. Beyond that, I mean, it is really, really, really cool that those human cells weren't immediately rejected. But beyond that, there's no way to know if they could up that yield and actually get more human cells to stick, if just by virtue of upping the yield, it wouldn't induce a rejection kind of protocol by the animal. So there's a lot that needs to be overcome here. The genetic engineering, I think, is one of the more interesting aspects of this. The use of CRISPR to be able to do this is fascinating. The fact that they were able to get some cells to stick is fascinating. But even if they used a knockout model like they used with the rats and the mice, right? Tell the pig that it can't grow a liver, for example, and then inject it with pluripotent human stem cells that would then be induced into growing a human liver. We have to remember that there's still going to be all sorts of pig cells that are going to innervate that liver. There's going to be blood cells that have to feed the liver. There's going to be nerve cells that have to communicate with the liver. So even at the level of a pure organ, which we're nowhere near getting to, the organ itself is going to be in many ways marbled in with the host cell. So the idea of growing a full organ that's somehow distinct from the host body and then being able to just cut it out and not have any pig cells involved is really far in the future. And of course, we would need that because if you then put a liver into a human being that has a bunch of pig cells marbled into it, our own bodies are going to reject it. So we have the problem of rejection on both sides of the transplant. So there's obviously a lot to go, but I think the basic research is super fascinating.
Yeah, this was an impressive sort of incremental advance in the basic science of understanding how, you know, this development works and development between different species. So solid research. The reporting is so hyped beyond where this is. That's, you know, where it gets crazy.
It's got people upset.
I also think that, you know, I don't think this is going to be the way that we're going to grow transplantable organs in animals, to be honest.
Yeah,
with
I think
you.
There's better options for that.
Why do you say
I
think, that, Steve?
Well, because of this problem, and Kara mentioned a bunch of them, it has to be mostly, if not all, human cells. And then what about the pig blood and vessels and nerves and all that stuff? And so what I think a better approach, and we've talked about this in the past, is we need to genetically engineer a pig that has a human immune system.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It doesn't have to be a human liver. It just needs to have a human immune system because that's where the rejection comes in. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't have to change anything else about the pig. Just change all of the immune proteins that recognizes self from non-self so that, you know, the essentially it's a human. Then you still have the problem of like one human can reject another human's organ, right? So that problem would still exist. But it's a lot worse if it's a different species. So it'll just get like pig organs up to the level of a generic human organ transplant. Mm-hmm. But of course, the quote unquote holy grail is to have organs that are identical to the recipient's.
Right, clone system. Yourself and take the organs.
Yeah, or, okay, one of two things. Grow them in vitro once we get better at these techniques, right? We think of it might be easier in an organism because that's a living incubator. It has all the things that you need to support life. If you want to grow it in vitro, meaning in the lab, like outside of the body in a petri dish, it's going to be much more difficult because you have to then replicate all of those things as best you can. That's one option. Another option would be to grow it inside your own body.
But I do wonder what impact CRISPR will have on all this. So imagine, so we could use CRISPR or whatever the tweaked version of it to create a breed of pigs that have a human immune system. And then when you are going to need an organ transplant, we can create an individual pig that has your immune system.
Wow. Yeah, that's true. And then you don't have to bear the burden. You know, and also you'll be able to kind of clean the cells up because the reason you may need a transplant is because yours aren't good. You know, like your DNA told your heart not to be amazing. And so you might need a clean, you know, heart where your DNA has actually been cleaned up using something like CRISPR, which is super cool.
I'm just hoping that there's a Bob on some island somewhere that looks like me but is only 5 years old and I can just harvest his organs when I need it.
That's right. That's the goal.
He's probably in a parallel universe, so you need to build – you got to go through a wormhole.
He's definitely there.
Yeah.
What if we're the parallel universe? People are going to be coming from another universe to harvest our organs.
Don't worry, we'll defeat them, Steve. Well,
that's
maybe
not
that's
right.
What dying is. It's just us giving our organs to the next universe.
Awesome. Yeah, but what would what would parallel universe rejection be like? You just explode when they try to put it in?
Yeah, but you just turn on the quantum transfusion phantasmagorizer and you're good.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, well, speaking of interesting research, Jay, there's a little bit of an update on the whole near-death experience thingamajig.
Thingamajig.
Thingamajig is a technical term.
Yeah, this is a
whatchamacallit.
A study that was looking at like an offshoot of like an NDE or a near-death experience. So we've all heard the expression where people say that their life flashed before their eyes or passed before their eyes. And this expression might be more than just a like a cultural thing that we developed. It could be based on real human experiences, according to what scientists from the Hadassah University in Jerusalem, and they asked over 200 people about their encounter with something called an LRE, which is a life review experience, the idea of your life passing before your eyes. They did a deep analysis of the 200 people, seven of them, they did a deep analysis of their cases, and those subjects that were selected for the study all shared accounts of seeing events from their lives. And oddly, though, the events rarely occurred in a chronological order. It wasn't like, you know, from birth to, you know, the moment that you're in at that particular time. It was like, you know, jumping around and all that stuff, which is more of like the way dreams work, you know, just, you know, chaotic.
In Flash Gordon with the doctor, he went backwards.
Yeah, remember that? And they froze the frame of him as an embryo, like he would perceive himself as an embryo.
That's right.
The researchers suggested from their study of the LREs that some parts of the brain that store memories are the last to stop functioning when a person is close to death. And there was a common theme here of massive time distortion. And one participant that was in the study wrote this really interesting thing. They said, there is not a linear progression. There is a lack of time limits. It was like being there for centuries. I was not in time space, so this question also feels impossible to answer. A moment in 1,000 years, both and neither. It all happened at once, or some experiences within my near-death experience were going on at the same time as others, though my human mind separates them into different events. Wow, there's a lot packed into that paragraph. Another thing participants said was that they could feel the pain of others, or they could sense the pain and sadness from other people in the room that were near them when they were close to dying. One person in particular described that they could see their father's childhood and the pain that their father experienced during his childhood. the researchers named some of the parts of the brain too, guys. I'd like to hear what you think about this. So these are parts of the brain that both store memories and continue to function longer than other parts of the brain in a lacking blood flow and lacking oxygen situation. It's the prefrontal, medial, temporal, and parietal cortices.
Parietal?
Parietal.
Parietal, exactly.
Yes.
Parietal cord. Now, Steve, what parts of the brain are this if you pointed to your head?
The parietal is like the side of your head.
Okay.
The temple is below that, right? So, like I would say, like at your eye level and back is the temple. Above that to the top is the parietal. Then you have the frontal lobes, which is your forehead, the occipital lobe, which is the back of your head.
What's prefrontal? Yeah,
prefrontal is just the front of the frontal.
Okay. So that's pretty cool, though, that these parts of your brain, they're saying, they can last longer without oxygen, and they're firing like crazy, and that's what's causing these LREs. I think that's really, really interesting.
And also, those aren't necessarily memory areas. I mean, there's memory in aspects in some of those areas, but when I think memory, I think specific memory areas like hippocampus.
Yeah, Steve, that is mesotemporal. So mesotemporal definitely is memory. Yeah.
What's the most sensitive?
Definitely hippocampus is one of which is the memory area.
Long-term memory,
damn,
not good.
That's a damn shame. Sucks.
I guess that could also explain why when people do have events like critical events and they lose consciousness or they have near drownings where they lose oxygen for a little while and then they're resuscitated, that they often do have memory loss.
A lot of things can cause memory loss because, you think about it. That
sensitive.
That there's a constant process of you having short-term memories and then those being communicated to long-term memory and then being consolidated into long-term memory. And anything that interrupts that process gives you amnesia. So it's very common, for example, for patients to have what we call amnesia for the event. So if they have a seizure, they really shouldn't remember the seizure itself. Amnesia for the seizure is very, very common. If you have head trauma, concussion, you have amnesia for the event. You may have a little bit of retrograde amnesia, so before the head trauma. So in other words, those 3 minutes of memories hadn't had a chance yet to go into the brain to long-term storage. So they get knocked out of your head and you never store them. But that may go back, we may go for like the whole day because you never had a chance to consolidate those memories. And then also, you have anterograde amnesia, meaning going forward because the brain's not working well enough to store new memories again until it heals to a certain point.
We know why it happens that you don't encode those memories during a traumatic event, but it's like kind of lucky that you don't encode those memories during a traumatic event. You know what I mean? Yeah. I wouldn't want to remember the car crash.
Yeah, I guess you're right, Kara.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
Well, maybe for you, it's inconvenient for us though because we like to.
I'm
know
sure.
What happened.
Yeah,
we like to get a history of exactly what you felt right up to the moment where you lost consciousness, and if you lose that information, it
doesn't help.
It doesn't help.
But it might help that person avoid, some post-traumatic stress
trauma.
Later. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right before it happened, there was a beam coming from a UFO that entered my head. That's important to know. Thank you.
All right, let's move on. Very quickly, this is a cool study. I wrote about this today on Science-Based Medicine. So this is about trying to figure out how to communicate with people who are locked in. And we've spoken about this on the show before,
horrible
the whole brain
condition.
Machine interface thing, which is advancing quite nicely. But there is one thing that we haven't been able to do. And actually, this was the most interesting part about this. I wasn't as aware of this before reading up on this. Locked in means that you are essentially paralyzed below the eyes. So you might be able to blink and look around, but you can't talk, you can't breathe on your own, you can't move your arms or legs, you're completely paralyzed. That can happen from a stroke or trauma. Basically, if you have damage, in a certain way to a certain level in the brainstem, you could still be alive, but you just can't move anything. There's also something called complete locked-in syndrome, which you can't even move your eyes.
Jesus.
So the study that I'm talking about, they looked at four patients with ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, that were on a ventilator and their disease, they were kept alive and their disease progressed to such a point that they had no motor function at all.
So they had no connection. Yeah. They couldn't write with their eyes. Because that's what everybody uses now to write and to steer their wheelchairs and to do it. They interact with the world using their eyes.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
So what do you do for those people, Steve?
Nothing. So that's why
lie in bed.
Terrible.
There's no way to communicate with them. There's no way to communicate with people who have complete locked-in syndrome.
So wait, I'm confused real quick. Sorry, just to clarify for my own understanding. When you're locked in, obviously through ALS, it's a motor problem only, meaning
correct.
That you can still feel things, you have, you
correct.
Know, you can still hear, you can still see, but if you can't move your eyes, is there atrophy to your vision?
Well, to like, the muscles that move your eyes.
Yeah, but not to like the muscles that kind of, if you can't like focus by pulling your pupil, you know, and having light reaction, like can they actually see?
That's a good question. I don't think that the muscles that influence focusing are affected because those are just different.
But so you almost have to turn their head in order to get their gaze.
Yeah, their eyes are locked
so
in one position in their head. Yeah.
God, that's horrible.
Oh my God. Just terrible.
Horrible.
So here's the thing I didn't realize until I looked into this study is that, so I thought, okay, man, we're making great progress. We've taught monkeys how to use a robotic arm, you know, just with their thoughts. And patients who are, you know, quadriplegic, for example, can move the cursor on a computer. So like, so we're there, right? People can communicate with their thoughts with a brain machine interface. Awesome. Mm-hmm. But apparently that doesn't work on people who are completely locked in for a very interesting reason that they can't be taught how to use the computer interface because they're not. There's no motor feedback, which apparently is necessary for the brain plasticity to sort of learn how to interface with the computer.
Oh, man. Talk about getting a bad shake on all levels.
Seriously.
Yeah. So it just hasn't worked. There's been several studies looking at these same techniques, the techniques that could teach a monkey to feed itself Cheerios with a robotic arm, and it just hasn't been able to communicate, even just yes or no. They're just trying to say, okay, you know, create one type of signal with your brain that is a yes and another type of signal with your brain that's a no. They haven't even been able to achieve that. So I wasn't aware that there was that real block here. And the thought is that it's because the brain's not getting the motor feedback because there's just, and that's necessary for the plasticity to kick in. Okay. So what the researchers did, they took four patients with complete locked-in syndrome from ALS. They said two were complete and two were approaching complete. So they were basically there, but maybe not 100%. And they looked at their brain two ways, one with functional near-infrared imaging, which looks at oxygenation of blood in the brain, and also EEG, scalp surface EEG, looking at the electrical activity in the brain. And then they calibrated the computer to figure out like what their brain would be doing in the yes or no condition. They said they asked them a question with a known answer, like, is the name of your husband Harold? Just to make up a question. So a yes or no question where they knew what the answer was. And then they instructed the subjects to, if the answer is yes, then say yes, 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 yes in your head for 15 seconds. And if it's no, then just say no, 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 no for 15 seconds. And then they looked at the activity in their brain, and then the computer was able to distinguish the yes state from the no state. But here's the thing. They only got up to about 60 to 70% accuracy. It was statistically significant, but still, that's really crappy. It's just yes or no. So
it's like not really useful. You know what I mean? Like in a real...
Well, actually, maybe more useful than you think. It's still really tedious because what they did was then they asked them other questions they didn't know the answer to. And the thing is they'd have to do it 10 times. And then say, so if 8 out of 10 times it gave the person gave a yes answer, they would consider that a yes. Right. So you can't ask the question once. You got to ask it 10 times and then say, okay, if it's clearly mostly yes or mostly no, but that's really tedious and doesn't always work. So that 60 to 70% is just really disappointing, but the researchers were excited because it's the first time anyone's achieved statistical significance with this kind of a paradigm. There wasn't much of a learning curve either. That's the other thing. And that still gets back to the lack of motor feedback. They also said that, you know, they know the answers to these questions. So they're just nothing different's happening. You know, what they're doing at the beginning of their trials is the same as what they're doing at the end of their trials. There's no feedback that is learning. You know what I mean? So that's interesting. So I still think we're not there. I mean, okay, they were able to eke out this 60-70%, you know, sensitivity, you know, and could theoretically be used in individuals if you believe that the 8 out of 10 is enough. That wasn't just by chance alone, right? You don't really know that. Yeah, it's interesting. So we definitely need to figure out some different approach. You know, which it's just the approach that we're taking right now. Is it working for this subset of patients? One thing that I thought of, so let's say you get diagnosed with ALS, you know, it's going to be 1.5 to 2.5 years, you know, a couple of years before you're at this point, maybe 3 years before you're at this point.
Pre-train your brain.
Use that time to train your brain to use the computer, the brain-machine interface.
That's a great idea, Steve.
Yeah, because they're already doing things like ALS patients know to bank their voices. They know, you know, they know what they're about to lose, so they start to do things so that they can use technology later.
Yeah, so you may become
add that
expert.
To the repertoire.
Yeah, you can become an expert at using the brain-machine interface before you completely lose your motor function. So I wonder if that would work. That would seem like a very interesting follow-up kind of study to do.
And so I'm wondering how many people, you know, choose to get the trach first of all, and then they really expand their life. Like it could be 10, 20 years after that if they're really on top of things. Look at Stephen Hawking. If they ever do progress to the point where they're fully locked in, like you described, I mean, what a life. Aren't they just living in a hospital bed doing nothing? They can't even navigate a wheelchair at that point.
So Stephen Hawking's not a good example because he didn't progress to that point.
You know, exactly.
Not all ALS patients progress at the same rate. Yeah. It's a long tail. Some people stabilize. It's a category of disease. Again, it's not one very specific disease. It's a clinical syndrome of your motor neurons are dying, upper and lower motor neurons are dying, but there could be different reasons why that's happening. So, but in my experience, and I've treated many patients with ALS, most decide not to go on a ventilator. That takes a lot of counseling. So, you know, from usually the second visit, you know, when you give them, you have to counsel them to accept their diagnosis. You go through, you know, make sure you've gone through the entire diagnostic procedure. And when you're, you know, you're certain that that's what they have, you have a lot of stuff to talk about to them about. And I start to introduce the idea of, yeah, this is, you know, these are the decisions that are coming up. I don't want you to tell me what they are now. I just want you to think about them. Then at some point, you know, hopefully about a year before the decision has to actually be made, you want the patient and their family to be comfortable with a decision about whether or not they want to be put on a ventilator when they get to the point that they can't breathe on their own. Yeah. Understanding that at that point, we will make you comfortable, but you will die. If you go on a ventilator, that's your life. You're on a ventilator. You're never going to come off the ventilator. And you will be laying in a bed on a ventilator.
Or in a chair.
Now, some people feel that their quality of life on a ventilator would be sufficient, and they want to do that. And and we support them in their decision. If they want to do that, that's fine. We'll put you on a ventilator. We'll take care of you. If you don't want to be put on a ventilator, that's fine. We'll make you comfortable. You know, that there's no problem either way. The only time it's an issue is when they didn't have enough time to make a decision ahead of time and be comfortable with their choice.
Right.
That's the only time.
So they're doing
it
out of panic. Yeah.
One way or the other, you know, but, and that, there's reasons why that might happen. Either just they presented late or they weren't properly counseled or whatever.
Yeah.
Or they just were in denial. I've had patients literally run out of the office and then come back a year later after pursuing worthless treatments for a year saying, okay, yeah, you know, except now that this is what's going to happen. But we've lost a year. You know, it's a year I didn't have a chance of trying to counsel them through what's going on. I have seen patients who were on a ventilator and miserable because they never really accepted their diagnosis and prognosis, and they went on a ventilator in denial. And those patients are miserable in my experience.
And then there's probably people like Steve Gleason. He might not be a good example either because he was in the NFL. You know, he probably had money from that. He had just had a baby. He had a lot to live for. And for him, getting a trach, and he's still mobile in his chair because he can steer his chair with his eyes, you know. So getting the trach really, like, opened up more years of a life that he loves living, you know, and he's an activist and he
does a lot
of great
work. That's great. Yeah. I often thought, because I've had a lot of time to think about this, like if I were in that situation, I probably would see, you know, if I could have enough of an intellectual life to make it worthwhile. I'm also really hoping that this kind of stuff is going to work out, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, and you could just put these people in a virtual reality, you know?
Absolutely. Right. Yeah, that would be, and the adaptive good technology use. Is there. But I guess it comes back to my original question is, like, not to sound insensitive, but how big of a problem is being totally locked in? Like, how many people in the grand scheme of things actually get the trach and then beyond that continue even after they've lost the ability to move their eyes without opting for, you know, end of life measures?
Yeah, but,
because it just sounds like such a difficult life.
Yeah, but that's not well, first of all, you'd be surprised at how many people who are locked in report that they're happy, actually. So don't
I more meant totally locked in.
Don't make it, well, like, we don't know because we can't communicate with them,
how can
right?
You know?
But exactly. What do they do?
The other thing is,
what do those
Kara,
people do?
Hang on. Nothing. They do nothing because nothing
you
can do.
You can't watch TV?
You could watch TV.
You could. Yeah,
you'd
they could watch TV.
Focus your head towards it.
Man, would I binge watch.
Kara, yeah, the other thing you have to think about is that if this were available, more people would opt for it, right?
So that's absolutely true. Yeah, that's true.
So,
yeah, we shouldn't discount it just because the population isn't there. The population isn't there because they don't have any options.
Right.
Or it's not there in the numbers. Yeah.
Well, Steve, exactly. what about more refined imaging technology to better distinguish the yeses and the noes?
Yeah, so I think – so there's two things here. So first of all, with the brain-machine interfaces, we've been picking the low-hanging fruit. So it may seem like we've made more progress than we have because we're really going for the easy things like motor control and just visual mapping and things like that. Abstract ideas, even yes and no, are hard. We have no idea what the brain is doing when it's thinking no or thinking yes. There's so many other things going on. Like, we don't know if the patient's paying attention, you know, or how well they're paying attention, or if they're distracted, or if they're thinking, Jesus Christ, my left finger itches, right? We have no idea what's going on in their head when we're telling them say yes or say no. So, it's very, very difficult. And we don't know how long it's going to take before we really start to crack that nut of trying to decode some of the more abstract processes of the brain, not just the ones that are kind of mapped to something physical. That's the easy part. It's tricky, but I do think we also need to get much higher resolution than scalp surface or, you know, than the techniques that we're using now. We really need electrodes next to brain cells.
Well, and that's the thing. You could go invasive with a lot of these people. They would probably opt for that because it's so pressing. It's so necessary.
Why not?
They can only gain. They can't
my hypothesis
really lose anything more.
Would be that they actually have a dulling of some of their sensory capabilities too. Some people might hypothesize that it's the opposite of that, but I would think that if you can't move and you can't react ever and you're just constantly in a noisy environment, you know what I mean?
Yeah, who knows where these people go in their minds. Yeah.
Exactly. To stop paying attention as much to what's actually happening in your ears and your eyes.
Yeah.
Ugh, yeah. It's fascinating and it's heartbreaking at the same time. So
sure
it's exciting to hear about improvements and advancements.
Right. And again, this is like with your research, Kara, the human pig chimera. This is something a little bit more than that, but this is very incremental. Incremental. But, you know, these have been adding up, you know, with the brain machine interface, and we can actually start to see some tangible effects from it. But this particular thing, you know, communicating even binary yes or no with the completely locked in patients has been difficult. You know, so even this small incremental advance is a little encouraging.
Yeah.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, The Great Courses Plus.
Steve, we all love to binge watch TV shows, but why don't we binge watch something that will actually teach us something? So you can learn and be entertained at the same time, right? The Great Courses are perfect for binge watching because they're online. You can stream them, and you're going to learn something.
You could even binge listen, which is what I like to do because I live in LA, so I'm always stuck in my car. Of course, they're presented by award-winning experts, and they run the gamut when it comes to topics. So pretty much anything you're interested in and want to learn more about, it's there on The Great Courses Plus. There's over 8,000 lectures, you guys.
We recommend watching Impossible: Physics Beyond the Edge. by Professor Benjamin Schumacher. This is a fascinating series of talks talking about fantastic things such as Maxwell's Demon, Absolute Zero, Quantum Tunneling, Mirror Worlds, What is Symmetry? So many fascinating topics. It's addicting and fascinating, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, and if you sign up now, the Great Courses Plus is going to give you the first month for free, first full month for free, but you need to go to our URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show. All right, Evan, there's another homeopathic piece of news here. Disappointment crap coming at it.
Of course. That's right, Steve. It's a good way to put it. The United States Food and Drug Administration, just from a few days ago, had this. A warning for everyone. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration announced today that its laboratory analysis found inconsistent amounts of belladonna, a toxic substance, in certain homeopathic teething tablets, sometimes far exceeding the amount claimed on the label. The agency is warning consumers that homeopathic teething tablets containing belladonna pose an unnecessary risk to infants and children and urges consumers not to use these products.
Not to mention they also don't work.
Well, that's kind of, I think, maybe the underlying point here. Yeah. This is not the first time the FDA has made really this sort of pronouncement, especially having to do with homeopathic teething products containing belladonna. I actually went online to research this particular product that the FDA was talking about. It's called Hyland's Baby Teething Tablets. And if you go to that website, they list the active ingredients, and there it is. Active ingredients among the things in there, belladonna, 12X HPUS. Now, 12X, as we have spoken about before when it comes to homeopathic concoctions, is a dilution amount. It's pretty dilute. It's been mixed quite a bit, 10 to the 12th power. So yeah, that's one with 12 zeros behind it. So what you have there is water.
Mm-hmm.
it's confusing what the FDA is exactly sort of telling us in this particular announcement. I doubt that it's about the dilution. It's probably, and I think, Steve, you'll back this up, some actual belladonna, which effectively contaminated the product, made its way into the product. And they're warning people that even these actual amounts, trace though they may be, can be harmful, especially to children.
Yeah, what that tells me, Evan, is that they're not diluting it 12X, right? It's variable. They're saying that, yeah, the actual concentrations of belladonna are all over the place. That's because it doesn't freaking matter how you dilute it or whatever, because it's magic potions. So yeah, they're not being really precise in exactly how they're just mass producing this stuff. My favorite aspect of mass produced homeopathic products is when they just dump it out, like they fill the tube,
mm-hmm,
and then they dump it out completely and then refill it. So they're not like measuring any kind of ratio. They're just saying, there's probably a little bit stuck to the inside of the tube. That's good enough.
It's no procedure.
They're just so cavalier about it because it doesn't matter. You know, and you have to think on some level they realize it doesn't matter. And so there's no quality control because the whole thing is nonsense. And that's a deeper issue that I think is really important because we see the same, mm-hmm, thing with a lot of supplements as well. The quality control is horrible. Yeah, you know what? When you believe in magic and nonsense, you can't expect really rigorous quality control from these people. So this is no shock at all.
This isn't the first time the FDA has gone particularly against this brand of teething tablets that they've specified. This was back in September 2016. Steve, you blogged about it. Other people have spoken about it. We may have even mentioned it on the show, I believe. At that time, the FDA warned then that people should throw out these products if they purchase them. They cannot be, there's no control. There is problems with the product and just best to really get rid of it and don't buy this product. When that came out, Hyland, the company itself, voluntarily stopped distributing the tablets in the United States. They still appear to be happily distributing to Canada and wherever else to make these kinds of things available, which is why the FDA is still essentially putting out warnings for them. Even though you can't get it in the United States anymore, you can get it elsewhere. And because this product is made in the United States, it's still under the FDA's, technically, their jurisdiction. So they're still obligated to issue these warnings based on whatever rules govern such announcements that they have to make. But it's a fall down definitely for the FDA. I mean, I looked for something definitive in which they've come out to say really a blanket statement about homeopathy and what it is and how it, why it doesn't work. And they don't have it.
You know, we're still waiting. We're still waiting for them to come up with their decision. They're reviewing their regulation of homeopathy, and we'll see. And I predicted they're going to disappoint us this year, but we will see what they come out with. Hopefully, they'll go the route of the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission.
FTC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and make a firm statement about, yeah, this is magic potions. They don't work. But like the one virtue, if you can call it that, of homeopathic products is that they don't have anything in them. So they're at least not going to cause actual poisoning. But they don't even have that anymore. You can't even count on that because they do sometimes have detectable amounts of their ingredients. You know, sometimes they have 1x or 2x or like in this case where they don't care. It's just all over the place in terms of how much they have. So you can't assume that homeopathic products have no active ingredients. And we often will warn skeptics who want to do like the homeopathic overdose demonstration. Mm. Know what you're getting, because I wouldn't do it with these teething tablets because, you know, you can get an overdose of belladonna. Yeah, absolutely.
That's for sure.
All right, Bob, this is a really fascinating one. I wrote about this myself. Tell us about metallic hydrogen.
Yes, this one definitely caught my attention, and I read it last week, I think right after we recorded last week. I'm like, yep, I'm so talking about this next week. So a new paper in Science reports that Harvard scientists have created the long-theorized metallic hydrogen in the lab, which could offer tremendous promise for modern electronics and even fusion reactors potentially. The paper's co-authors are Isaac Silvera and Ranga Dias. Now, the press release by Silvera said something like this. This is the holy grail of high-pressure physics. It's the first ever sample of metallic hydrogen on Earth. So when you're looking at it, you're looking at something that's never existed before. So what is this stuff? What's going on? Well, regular hydrogen needs no introduction, of course. Some sources say that this lightest element makes up 90% of the visible universe and 3/4 of its mass, not including dark matter, of course. Hydrogen also when you bring it to -253 Celsius, it enters its liquid form, and which also makes a great rocket fuel, by the way, of course. Now, metallic hydrogen is a different beast altogether. Well, go ahead, guys, say it altogether. Metallic hydrogen. Never mind.
Different beast.
Yeah, nice try. Too late. So, in 1935. Physicists Eugene Wigner and Hillard Bell Huntington hypothesized that extreme pressure on the order of 25 gigapascals turns hydrogen into a metal. This became known as the Wigner-Huntington transition. In fact, that the paper itself was called the observation of the Wigner-Huntington transition to metallic hydrogen. So that's what it's called. But attempts in all those years have failed in the past because it turned out that much more than 25 gigapascals were needed, and also that the diamond anvils being used kept cracking, as far as I could tell. That was a big problem. So it looks like one of their key breakthroughs then was that there was a new way that they came up with to polish their diamonds to prevent the cracking, which appears to have worked. The next step then would be to put the diamond anvil in a cooling apparatus called a cryostat, and then once the hydrogen is between the two diamond anvils, the last step is then to turn the screw to slowly squeeze the sample of hydrogen and just ratchet up that the pressure. So yeah. when they hit 335 gigapascals, the sample turned black, which was expected actually, since it's a known form of hydrogen that absorbs light. So that was kind of a good sign. Then when they hit 495 gigapascals, what the hell's gigapascals? 495 of them, whatever they are, is 5 million times sea level pressure, or 72 million pounds per square inch. So that's what 495 gigapascals are. Intense pressure, obviously. So at that point, the sample turned shiny, which is a good thing. That's the hallmark of the transition to metallic hydrogen. So what are the if this is true, what are we talking about here? Why, you know, what could happen? So the hope is that if the pressure is slowly released, it won't turn right back into a gas. and that it will retain its new metallic form. That's the assumption. We don't know what's going to happen yet. So let's assume that that's what's going to happen. They take off the pressure and you have metallic hydrogen. What are the possibilities? So at that point, there's two possibilities. Either it's stable or it's metastable. If it's stable, that's awesome. That means it's kind of like diamonds. You know, diamonds, carbon, lots of pressure for lots of time. And when the pressure is released, you have this stable diamond, which is an awesome thing. So the chances are that if this is stable, what we would end up with would be a high-temperature superconductor, electricity would flow through it without resistance. We all know how awesome that is. Most superconductors need to be at near absolute zero to superconduct. Some can conduct at higher temperatures, as high as minus 70 C, which is great, but they haven't been making too much progress with that. Lately, incremental stuff, nothing major. So the possibilities of room temperature superconductors are endless and giggle inducing. It's so awesome to think about what can be done. But remember, even that assumes that even if it's stable, that they are also making it in quantities. Because if you can't make it in quantities, you're not going to be making too much of any room temperature superconducting material anytime soon. There's also other things that stable metallic hydrogen can produce. It can potentially produce novel quantum states like superconducting superfluids or metallic superfluids with very weird reactions to magnetic fields and rotations. That's the kind of stuff that if you looked at it, you'd be like, what the F is that? That would be really interesting. Even, you know, more fascinating than even, say, superconductivity applications. But those are theoretical, so we're not sure. Okay, so those are the options for stable metallic hydrogen options. So the other option, as I said, was metastable. It could potentially be not stable, but metastable at room temperature. That means that the material could reach, it could be in some equilibrium state, but it could also relatively easily, I think, evaporate into a gas from its surface. That might sound annoying and unfortunate, but actually that's awesome because that would make an incredible rocket fuel, because that means you'd have this dense metallic hydrogen that could expand incredibly into its gaseous form that you could then burn with oxygen, which would then make it potentially four times the energy density of our best fuel. And that would be a sort of revolution in spaceflight. That would be a huge advance. Four times the energy density doesn't sound like a lot. Trust me, that's awesome. Another option with metastable metallic hydrogen is the application towards fusion reactors. There's some speculation that metallic hydrogen deuterium could be very helpful in achieving fusion, especially regarding lower pressure requirements. So that would be a big bonus. So those are some of the cool things that we could potentially get out of this if it pans out. But there's a little dose of skepticism I've got to throw on here.
I'd say more than a little dose.
Okay, I'd say a medium dose. There's a group of scientists like Paul Lobert, who's a physicist at the French Atomic Energy Commission. He's tried to make metallic hydrogen in the past, and I don't think this is sour grapes when he said, "I don't think the paper is convincing at all." And he actually has some good points, very good points. There's one data point. They made one measurement of the reflectivity of this material when it went from black to highly reflective. One data point. Sure, it could be metallic hydrogen, but it could also be something called the alumina coating of the diamond, which is put on there to prevent hydrogen from making it brittle and cracking. That they didn't rule that out. They did not repeat the experiment yet. They plan on it, but they have not done it yet. So all of that makes me think, all right, just don't get your hopes up. You can get them hope a little bit because this is, you know, a very interesting possibility. But this one definitely has some hurdles to jump over before we could do our happy science dance. So keep an eye on it, but don't get too excited.
So
yet.
Bob, when I wrote about this for my blog, we got into a conversation in the comments about, well, why would they publish this with one data point without replicating it and before easing the pressure off and seeing what the hell happens.
I don't get that. That's bizarre.
So my speculation was, I bet they were rushing to beat out competitors to be first to publish.
That would make sense.
And my suspicions were confirmed to some degree by somebody who's worked in high energy physics. So one of my commenters, Anne-Marie Schaefer-Richards, has worked in Silvera's lab. She said that Ranga Diaz contacted her a few months ago and for feedback on the manuscript, but she didn't reply because she had relationships with other people who were working in the same era. She says this has been a fierce competition going back years, and everyone is really trying to be the first ones to get it, and they're sniping at each other's results, and it's really super competitive. So these guys raced, to publication as soon as they had a single data point. They didn't bother to replicate it. So this has to be considered an extremely preliminary result until it gets confirmed and replicated.
Right.
Because it's because of the field in which it's operating. This is almost like Pons and Fleischmann level cold fusion.
Yeah, that's
rushing
what I'm
to
feeling.
The media. Not quite. Mm. Not quite.
Well, yeah, but, I wouldn't say that. But
it has a reminiscent of it. Oh, they're racing to beat other people out, so they're not being quite as careful as they should be.
So it's not necessarily incompetence, but a race to the history books.
Yeah,
in their minds.
Exactly. So we really just have to wait and see. You know, if other labs can do this, if they can do it again, if they can meet the objections of their competitors who are trying to beat them out. And we also have to see what happens when they slowly release the pressure.
We don't know
if it'll be stable or metastable. I know and one of the researchers said we can speculate endlessly, or we could do one experiment and we could see what happens.
Just turn the damn knob.
But I was a little disappointed at the reporting of this because of how much with the human pig hybrid thing. They barely talked about the science itself. They just talked about all the fabulous applications which may never manifest.
Right.
You know, it's like if all these 20 things turn out to be true, you know, we could have these wonderful, you know, applications of this. Then that was the story. The story was we have these applications, they're coming soon, not, you know, what the actual science was. And that's just unfortunate, but that's unfortunately that's par for the course with this kind of science news reporting.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously love the potential applications, especially when I started reading about the quantum fluid possibilities, which I hadn't anticipated and hadn't read anywhere else, except when I really did a deep dive. It's like, oh, imagine that. That would be really fascinating. So, I love talking about that. But it's a balance. You got to talk about the science and balance it with the holy crap, look what could happen stuff.
Yeah, but you also have to make sure you're putting it into the context of how speculative that is.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Like, there are non-trivial things that have to happen, you know, for any of those applications to be manifest, like being able to produce more than infinitesimal amounts of it. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
So last week I played this noisy. Now, to get it right out of the way in the beginning, that is not Bob's vibrator running out of batteries.
Dude, I plug it in. Come on.
No Kara. Judgment.
None. Kara, oh, my God. Oh. Uh-huh.
I know. Well, I'm a woman, and we all have a vibrator.
Well, guys, okay. What is that?
I don't care. I want to hear more about Kara's vibrator.
See, that was just empathy. That's what you heard.
Sputnik.
I don't know, but there's something about it that I like. I like the sound of it.
Yeah, right? Something appealing about it.
It has a repetitive, it repeats the same four tones or notes, whatever you want to call them.
And those tones are like just at the right frequency that, like, I don't know, I feel them in my spine.
Yeah. Yeah, there is something like really awesome and old school about that. I'll give
you
that.
Retro, something retro for sure.
All right, well, Bob, you nailed it. It's Sputnik.
Yeah.
Sputnik.
I was shocked. Two people, I think, emailed me and got it right.
What?
Yeah.
Only two.
I expected like a tsunami of emails. So let me tell you a few awesome things about Sputnik. So Sputnik 1 was the first artificial satellite to reach orbit. That's why most of us know about it.
What a milestone.
It was launched from a secret rocket base in the Ural Mountains in Soviet Central Asia. It weighed 83.6 kilograms, which was 184.3 pounds. It was 0.58 meters across or 1.9 feet wide. It's bigger than I thought. For some reason, I always thought it was tiny.
That's like soccer ball size, right? That good comparison?
That sounds like, that's like the idea I had in my head. Actually, yeah. I think I thought Sputnik was bigger.
I was thinking beach ball, at least.
Sputnik 2 was a lot bigger. Maybe that's what you're picturing.
Yeah, it could be.
Twice as big.
All right, so the New York Times, guys, explained the meaning of the word Sputnik, which I specifically looked up. Something that is traveling with a traveler. Additionally, the traveler is the Earth traveling through space, and the companion traveling with the Earth is its satellite.
I like that. They're friends.
That's nice.
That's cool, yeah. It had a simple radio transmitter, which is the thing making that noise, and it broadcasted beeps for 23 days until October 27th, 1957, when the battery died. The four legs of Sputnik, if you picture Sputnik in your mind, those are radio antennas. Those are the things sending out
the... Yes, they were. The beginning of the space race.
Sputnik maintained orbit until January 4th, 1958, when it re-entered and burned up in the Earth's atmosphere. So, unfortunately, it's not still out there, or it wasn't retrieved.
Well, it's good. It's not space junk anymore.
That's true.
Yeah. That's true. It would otherwise be clogging up
but
the
But it would have been cool if we could have retrieved it somehow.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. What an artifact.
Think about it. That's a goddamn milestone. The first satellite. What a feather in their cap. That was
also
wonderful.
It's also so iconic. Like, in so many... I mean, there's a whole, you know, mid-century architecture and design I'm really, really into. And there, every product that you find, it's like a cool chandelier and a cool, it's a Sputnik chandelier. It's the Sputnik chair. It's the Sputnik, like everybody used that as an actual design feature.
Yeah.
And and guys, don't forget, didn't Sputnik cause a science revolution?
Yeah.
In the United States, in teaching science, that was huge.
Well, Bob, that was huge. My last point was that it heated up the space race between the U.S. and Russia. Sputnik actually was what started the space race.
And anything that improves science teaching is good in my book.
So David Van Camp was the first person to send it in. He also talked about the fact that we mentioned the right stuff. So that's pretty cool. He thought that that at one point in the movie, Steve, maybe you remember that they could hear the Sputnik signal.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's when he runs into the room down the hallway. They call it Sputnik, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you for sending in your win, David. You will be sent a very nice set of china. That Evans wants to get rid of. Just kidding. Anyway, so let's go on to the new noisy. This week's noisy, sent in by Ryan Laney.
Is that a big-ass didgeridoo?
Yeah, didgeridoo.
Sounds like a didgeridoo.
It does. At the first quarter of that sounded like the E.T. aliens. The E.T. aliens.
Yeah. I thought that, too.
So, yeah. Okay, sure. I think any reasonable person would say that sounded like a didgeridoo. It's a little more complicated than that, so good luck. So, if you heard anything cool this week, or you want to guess what the hell that was, WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. We have a quick, fun email this week. This one comes from Brooke Osler from Salt Lake City. And Brooke writes, "My question relates to gravity on Earth in relationship to the rotation of the Earth. I would assume that a person standing on the equator would weigh more than if the same person was standing on one of the poles." Actually, I think they got that backwards.
Yeah, backwards.
It seems to me if a person was traveling roughly 1,000 miles an hour at a circle, the centrifugal force would be enormous. And without that force, it seems a person would be crushed at the poles. I know this isn't the case because people have visited the poles without being crushed. Does centrifugal force not play any role because of the curvature of the Earth is so subtle over distance? Or is a person's weight in the grand scheme of things not significant? So, okay, the question is, I'm going to strip this down. Do you weigh more at the poles than you do at the equator? Because at the equator, the centrifugal force of you spinning around the Earth is counteracting some of your weight, whereas you're effectively not spinning at the poles, right? Mm-hmm. What do you guys think? Okay.
Well, it's not doesn't sound unreasonable.
Yeah.
Sounds reasonable.
Yeah. Maybe just a teeny tiny amount.
I think it's vanishingly small. Yeah.
So NASA has an answer. I'm just going to read NASA's answer. NASA writes, yes, you do, because at the equator, the centrifugal force due to the spinning of the Earth is at its maximum and vanishes at the poles. This means that the attractive force of gravity is slightly reduced because it is directed towards the center of the Earth, while the centripetal force is directed outward from the center. That was a little confusing. Mm-hmm. Centripetal force is a force directed inward. So gravity is a centripetal force, right? It's directed centripetal, directed inward. Centrifugal force is an illusory force, right? It's the tendency of something that's traveling in a curved line,
right?
To go in a straight line so that it feels like you're being pushed outward, but it's a frame of reference kind of illusory force, whereas the centripetal force is what's holding you in. That's a real force. That makes sense?
Yep.
All right. Mm-hmm. NASA continues. The effective acceleration of gravity at the poles is 980.665 centimeters per second, while at the equator, it is 3.39 centimeters per second less due to the centrifugal force. If you weighed 100 pounds at the North Pole on a spring scale, at the equator, you would weigh 99.65 pounds.
Ooh.
Or 5.5 ounces less. 5.5 ounces out of 100 pounds.
That many ounces.
That's awesome. Yeah. You'd also be more tan. You'd weigh less and you'd be more tan. I love the equator diet. I want to go on it.
Oh, yeah. Sign me up.
That's awesome.
It's the latest.
That greatest. Was cool.
So what do you think, guys? The equator diet?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Instantly lose 5.5 ounces. If you if you originally live at the North Pole.
That's right.
If you live
We're at 41 degrees
41,
north.
Not as much.
No, but I could do better than that. What you have to do is find a place on the equator where there's also a natural minimal amount of mass below you. Because the distribution of the mass around the Earth varies by an amount that's completely measurable and would affect your weight in a measurable way as well.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
But that's even more insignificant than the centrifugal force. Yeah.
99.64 instead of 65.
All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. We have yet another theme this week. I'm theme happy recently. This theme is horrible things animals do to other animals.
Oh, cool.
Well, that's a broad category.
Unless they want them to be done to them.
All right, you'll see what I'm saying.
Are these consenting animals?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
No.
Okay, are you ready?
It's not a symbiotic relationship thing? Okay.
Not symbiotic. Not at all. Okay, here we go. Item number one. Manatees are highly territorial and protective of their food source and are known to attack and kill competitors by laying on top of them in shallow water until they drown. Item number two. The crypt keeper wasp lays its eggs in the nest of the gall wasp, where hatchlings infest their brains, compelling them to dig out of the nest, but in a hole that is too small, so they get stuck. Then the crypt keeper eats them from the inside out until they finally burst forth through their head.
Whoa.
And item number three, sea otters have been observed raping baby harbor seals to death, and sometimes keeping and continuing to copulate with the corpse for up to a week.
What?
Jay, go first.
These, you know, manatees, man, they're devils on the inside. They're highly territorial and protective of their food source, which is like a head of lettuce, and are known to attack and kill competitors, I guess of rabbits? I don't know, by laying on top of them in shallow water until they drown. Okay, this is like very unmanatee as far as the world knows. If that's true... Let's see here. The crypt keeper wasp lays its eggs in the nest of the gall wasp, and these hatchlings infest their brains, compelling them to dig out of the nest, but in a hole that is too small, so they get stuck. I believe that is so disgusting that is science.
Hmm.
This last one, sea otters have been observed raping baby harbor seals to death. What the hell? And sometimes keeping and continuing to copulate with the corpse for up to a week. Sweet mother of Christ. I'm like, I'm thinking that I'm just going to pick the one that's the least offensive, and that's going to be the fiction. So I'm going to go with the manatees as the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, this is just bizarre shit right here. I have a hard time imagining, you know, manatees, these kind of corpulent mermaids. I can't imagine them doing that stuff. And the sea otters, necrophiliac sea otters. What the hell? Bob. So I'm going to pick the Crypt Keepers because I love the Crypt Keeper. And I think that it is...
Isn't that from Tales from the Crypt?
Yes. What strikes me is that they... What's required here and what's critically important is that the hole, they're digging out of the nest and the hole is made too small so they get stuck. And then it eats through them and comes out the head. I think it... That doesn't sound like a reliable strategy to me. Like, yes, make this a little bit too small, big enough for the head, but not anywhere. That just doesn't sound like a reliable strategy for them always getting stuck, or even most of the time. So what the hell? I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Evan.
The sea otters one is the most disturbing one, and that's and the other two are pretty disturbing. Oh, gosh. I want the sea otters one to be fiction. I mean, I really... I'm disturbed by this. I almost need it to be fiction if I'm going to sleep tonight. Yeah.
I'll sleep like a baby.
Which means it's probably science. Damn it. Crypt Keeper or manatees? Well, manatees. Territorial, sure. Protective of their food source. I don't know. I don't know that they kill their competitors this way. Actually drown them. I mean, wouldn't... What, like a manatee can't get out of being drowned that way? I almost think it's...
But wait, is it saying your competitor is another manatee?
Isn't that what we're saying?
It just says your competitors.
It's not specific.
Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah, I assumed it was
so
as
it
well.
Could be various. It could be a whole bunch of things.
It could be
things.
Like a turtle.
Ooh. I guess whatever's got its food.
Yeah.
Well, what the hell competes with a manatee?
I don't even know what manatees eat.
Look, they eat lettuce, so it's probably rabbits. Yeah.
The manatee. Are they also known as the sea cow?
They are known as the sea cow.
I'll put my nickel down. Bob, I'll go with you this time. I'm going to say the Crypt Keeper one is the fiction, and I'll cite the exact same reasons that you pointed out.
GWB. You won't cite them. You'll copy them.
I'm going to GWJ with
consider them cloned.
I think that...
Ooh.
I'm pretty confident that the Crypt Keeper Wasp one is science. I don't know. There's a lot of detail. This is the most detailed one, so a lot of little things could be wrong in it. You know, maybe it's not the gall wasp, or maybe the hole's not too small so that they get stuck. But wasps are like creepy in general, and I don't like them. And I also know that there's a lot of like weird parasitic wasp ant stuff where they inject
the zombie
things.
Ants.
Yeah, there's just a lot. I don't know. It just seems like likely. I think the two that are bothering me are the marine mammal ones. Marine mammals are very rapey, and they're jerks. Like dolphins are quite rapey. I also feel like I read somewhere that the majority of diseases that marine mammals get are STDs. I know, which is insane.
Yeah, that's right. I remember reading that.
The sea otter one is going to be fiction, science all the way.
So I kind of think that just for that reason alone, like my foundational knowledge should not be guiding me in this direction. I'm going to go with Jay and say that manatees don't like smother. I mean, they would be good at smothering because they're sea cows, but I'm going to assume they don't smother their competitors because I want to remember them being so sweet.
Okay, so We'll start with three, since you all agree that these cute, adorable little sea otters
stop
have been observed raping cute, adorable little baby harbor seals
so
to
horrible.
Death, sometimes keeping and continuing to copulate with the corpse for up to a week. You all think that's real, and that one
I really hope
is science.
Oh, damn.
We're so morbid.
What sea otters do, so as part of sea otters' normal sexual behavior, the males will hold the female's head down under the water while they copulate with them. And 10% of the time, the female sea otters die.
What?
During that process.
So sad.
It's not worth it.
And apparently,
Well, it must be. There's enough room to reproduce that they haven't, you know.
Yeah. Apparently, baby harbor seals, they look a lot, I guess, like female sea otters. So the male sea otters will go over to a baby harbor seal, hold its head under the water while it copulates with it, while it rapes it, until they drown.
Okay.
Like, they'll do it for an hour, you know, until they're drowned.
An hour, huh?
But the weird part about them screwing them after they die, they just floating around with them?
I guess so. So one comment said that after it raped the baby seal to death, the male otter just sort of laid back and started grooming itself.
Okay.
Smoked a cigarette.
Just casual. Yeah, the otter equivalent of that, I guess. Just
like, so they're fully unaware, I guess. I mean, right? I don't know.
No, sea otters are massive jerks. Kara is right.
Jeez.
They're just horrible.
They're also really scary looking. If you
talk about,
like, they're cute until, have you seen any of the like deep sea footage or the underwater footage of them hunting? It's horrifying.
I don't.
Yeah, they're like scary predators.
They say honey badger don't care. Sea otter don't care.
Let's go back to number one. Manatees are highly territorial and protective of their food source and are known to attack and kill competitors by laying on top of them in shallow water until they drown. Jay and Kara, you think this one is the fiction. Bob and Evan, you think this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Ah, man, I can't get a break.
Yeah.
So I tried, manatees, Bob. Manatees are the nicest animals in the animal kingdom. They are complete. They're not territorial at all. Uh-huh. They love to hug and kiss each other.
They share.
They are very, very touchy. They share. They help each other out. If food's scarce, they help each other
out. So they're the bonobos of the sea.
As a matter of fact, Steve, they're upset that you did this news item, this fake news item about them.
I had to slander those manatees. They are the super, super nice animals. They don't have a horrible bone in their body. Now, the crypt keeper wasp lays its eggs in the nest of the gall wasp, where hatchlings infest their brains, compelling them to dig out of the nest, but in a hole that is too small, so they get stuck. Then the crypt keeper eats them from the inside until they finally burst forth through their head. That is science.
There you go.
Wasps are horrible parasites sometimes. You're right, Kara. This one was sent to me by a listener, Steve Harris, and then I built the other ones around that. I said, yeah, that's a horrible thing. So I found a couple of the horrible things. I had to make up one. But I had to find like the least likely animal, like the manatee, and make up something horrible about them so that it was clearly a fiction. But yeah, I mean, insects, don't get me started on insects. They do all kinds of horrible things. You know, we've had parasite ones before.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, parasites. I could do a dozen science fictions about the horrible things animals do to each other. There's just many, many, many examples.
To rename the segment.
I'm trying to find a scary picture of a sea otter underwater hunting on Google Images, and every sea otter, even when I put all these modifiers like super scary, ugly sea otter, they're all just adorable.
They're adorable.
Just everything I see is adorable.
They have good public relations.
Good PR. Yeah, really very good propaganda.
Their lobbyists are on top of this.
It's like, here's a picture of two sea otters floating on their backs and holding hands.
Every picture is like that. Yeah,
that must be all they do.
So adorable. Dreaming of raping baby seals.
Oh, God. They're conspiring.
So obviously, you know, this is just nature red in tooth and claws. Animals do whatever their instincts drive them to do. You know, that's it.
Nature is without care.
It's just amoral, right? It's just whatever survives works. That's it. There's no morality in nature.
Steve, what did Goldblum say in The Fly? Ever hear of insect politics? What was that? What was the phrase? It's like, no, you've never heard of that because there is no politics. It's brutal.
Oh, yeah. Insects are horrible.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Scientists are just as bad as the rest of the public in following fads and being influenced by mass enthusiasm. Oh yeah, scientists are people too. And we are reminded of that by Vannevar Bush. And if you don't know who Vannevar Bush was, he was an American engineer, inventor, and science administrator who during World War II headed the U.S. Office of Scientific Research and Development. He was chiefly responsible for the movement that led to the creation of the National Science Foundation. So, almost a forgotten superhero in a certain sense. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think that scientists may have a little bit of resistance to fads and fallacies, but, you know, probably not. That's probably
not. I think we've run into too many that, you know, have proven, unfortunately, Vannevar Bush correct.
Yeah, definitely there's a lot of individual scientists. You can't assume that all scientists are rational all the time. Scientists can believe weird stuff for weird reasons, and then that could infect their science, unfortunately. That's why you can never invest real authority in any individual scientists, because they're just quirky people too.
Exactly right. And being aware of that is very, very important, especially for the scientists themselves.
All right. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
And thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. Surely.
Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.